Diese Folge wird euch präsentiert von Tinder. Ich bin mir relativ sicher, wenn du mir hier zuhörst, dass du genauso wie ich auch so eine Schwachstelle für diese ganzen romantischen BookTok-Bücher hast. Zwei Menschen lernen sich kennen, sie mögen sich am Anfang noch nicht, aber dann verlieben die sich natürlich. Mein Vorschlag wäre jetzt aber, dass du deine ganz persönliche Love-Story in deinem echten Leben einfach selber schreibst und das mit Tinder. Bei Tinder findest du nämlich genau das, wonach du suchst, sei es die ganz große Liebe, sei es ein unverbindliches Treffen oder vielleicht möchtest du auch einfach nur neue Menschen kennenlernen. Also, schreibe dein eigenes romantisches Buch und starte dein nächstes Kapitel mit Tinder jetzt downloaden.
Hi, this is Sherelle Dorsey from TED Tech, and this episode is brought to you by Solidigm. The world runs on data, and data relies on storage. But most businesses rarely think about how crucial that storage really is. The truth is, it's no longer just a commodity. With new demands and constraints, especially from AI, the old ways of managing data are holding innovation back. Solid-state storage from Solidigm is changing that. It helps reduce energy use, shrink physical footprints, and accelerate data at the edge, unlocking more from your AI infrastructure. Learn more at whatsthestateofyourstorage.com.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuckocrats? What the fucking Adians? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. How's it going there? Everything all right? Today, I talked to Moon Zappa. She was on episode 434 back in 2013. And we actually started dating a little while after that. God, I can't believe that. I can't believe that that's like over 10 years ago. I can't even, like, I don't even know how I was, who I was that. I don't get it. My timelines are fucked up. Moon and I knew each other way back in the day, probably in the 90s. We had met and we were pals and we kind of, I felt like we should probably date. You know, there was a little back and forth there that was, you know, very kind of exciting and loaded up and, you know, crushy. And it just never happened, you know. And then we come together again in 2013, and it was one of these things where it was like, oh my God, we had just both broken up from people. We were both just freshly out of relationships, and we thought, like, man, this is it. This is it. This is our moment. And what we didn't really take into consideration fully, I didn't certainly, because I'm a dumb shit. It's not a dumb shit. Bottom line is the relationships we had gotten out of were both very bad for both of us. Very traumatizing, damaging, crazy, and really hard situations. But we were both free, but like freshly free. Like, you know, really like weeks, months, maybe not even months. And we just locked in with each other. And I know that some of you know the term trauma bonding, but and that's sort of like that's an umbrella statement. If you are a traumatized person or an emotionally compromised person because of whatever you were brought up with or whatever your liabilities are, whatever you've been through, it's very hard to get around the trauma bonding. Trauma bonding is very exciting. It's an easy path in a lot of ways. To a type of intimacy that is just, based in desperate need to feel better and to do things differently. It's not really rooted in all the good things, but it's a thing. And I'm not going to diminish our relationship at all, but it was difficult from the get-go because these people we had broken up with were sort of still lingering around in our hearts and our minds and physically. And it just became very difficult, very fast. It was very hard. And, you know, there were things that happened in her life and in my life, you know, that were, it just became, I just was not prepared for any relationship. I'm not sure I am now, but I don't think we were in an emotional position, either of us, to really handle it. And then her mom got sick. And then, you know, I had, you know, my ex was being pretty, a little bit persistent. Just, it was all, chaos in a way. And it didn't last that long. It lasted about 6 months. And we were just dealing with the heavy burdens of our own lives. And then it just was not, we couldn't deal with the burdens of each other's lives, certainly. And it was difficult. And it kind of burned down in about 6 months. And I had to, I don't know. It stopped. It was not a great ending. I think we were together about 6 months, and I just couldn't do it for many reasons. And it was never really resolved or anything like that. It was a fairly clean break. And this is really the first time that we've talked much since then. We've said hi here and there and texted occasionally. But the bottom line is, she wrote this amazing book about growing up in the Zappa household and the sort of trauma that created, and what it did to sort of her sense of self and her life. And there's a lot of great stuff about kind of living with emotional trauma that causes, psychological difficulties, relationship difficulties, life difficulties. But there's also this amazing poetic illustration of life at that time in that house with those people, with Frank and Gail and Amit and Dweezil and Diva and that whole world of that Frank had created, but also the world of Hollywood and her own opportunities. It's really an amazing document of a very specific music history, but also a very kind of painful and difficult memoir about her own psychological, emotional, and physical experience of being in an emotionally chaotic environment. So I love the book. And I think she's a very beautiful writer, a lot of poetry in her. So that's exciting. And you'll hear it. I would like at this point in time, if I could, to come out and, and identify as a childless cat lady. I don't really jump on the cultural meme train, or, I'm not following intensely what's going on, though I am more than excited about what's going on. I mean, I just love that, the Democratic machine is just punching Trump in the kidneys of his vanity over and over again. Poof, poof, just punching him in the kidneys of his ego. Poof. It's very exciting. Again, I don't know where it's going to go or how it all pans out, but whatever's happening now, it's giving me a little pep in my step. You know what I'm saying? But the childless cat lady thing, I identify as a childless cat lady man. And this whole fucking framing, this whole idea, and I've talked about it on stage, it's like, just look, some people just don't want kids for whatever reason. It's okay. There's plenty of kids. And maybe their reasons for not wanting them is actually saving the world, as opposed to thinking we're running out of children, or the right type of people aren't having children, or that everybody should have children because we're no different than dogs or lizards. You got to trust a person's individual choice. This is the big problem with whatever the fuck is happening right now in terms of the kind of fascistic nature of Christian legislation, is that it's denying people choice on all levels. Just shut the fuck up. Let people live the fucking life they want. But, the kids thing, it's like, look, if somebody says, I don't want to have kids because, I'm fucked up and I haven't got my shit together and I don't want to pass that along, well, good. Or if they don't want to have kids because of environmental reasons, or they don't, they're not prepared for the responsibility, or for whatever reason, who gives a fuck? Just shut up. Go enjoy your kids. And the idea that childless people, don't care about America is crazy. They might care about America more. What do you think? Because you don't have a horse in the race, that you don't give a fuck about the race? I mean, it's just so fucking stupid. I just don't know who they're playing to. Just let people fucking live the lives they want to live. And this idea that you're going to make it more difficult to divorce people, even in domestic violence situations or complete misery. It's like, what is that?
What kind of making abortion illegal, making divorce illegal or impossible, and calling people who don't have children, treasonous or un-American. It's like, shut the fuck up. Let people live the lives they want. Why is the right wing Christian machine so dead set in government running everyone's fucking lives and their personal choices? Holy Christ. I mean, you want to have a kid that you don't want to have? You want to bring a kid up in an environment that you can't get out of, even though it's violent and abusive? You want to have, you know, a kid because you're forced to? Or you want to have a kid, you know, that comes into the world and there's no love for that kid? I mean, what kind of kids are they trying to make? This idea that the kids can just, you know, suck it up? Yeah, sure, kids are tough and they eventually find their way, most of them. But you want that trauma at the core of their being, that you know, to be, you know, violently parented or neglectfully parented or abused or unwanted or, you know, struggling with parents who were not, you know, mentally ready or able or emotionally ready or able to have children? You want to just force them into that situation against the will of the parents that maybe didn't want to be parents? I mean, what kind of people are you making? I got an idea, and I've talked about this before. I tried to make it a joke years ago. You're creating angry people. You're creating people that have to struggle from day one. You're creating people with emotional voids in their hearts from bad parenting. And what is the common factor of those people? Well, they're either going to sort of lose control of their lives and end up in a bad situation, perhaps in prison, which happens to be a big business, or they're going to end up, you know, misguided and lost until somebody can take over their brain and focus that anger and terror and fear and grievance of emotional neglect and focus it on, I don't know, bad intentions, misguided political warfare, fascism. Tell me about it. Am I just making this up? If you have trauma or you decide not to have a child because of your particular precarious emotional situation, if you decide that you have not been able to process your trauma to the point where you can be responsible enough to have kids without passing that trauma along generationally, if you don't have the will to kind of stop the cycle of trauma and abuse that has traveled down your lineage for however long it's traveled down your lineage, then, and you decide not to have kids, good, don't. Don't. It's not an experiment. Trauma is generational. Hate is generational. Anger is generational. I wouldn't say it's genetic, but it's close. It's right alongside of that. It's right alongside of it. How you're wired by the emotional motherboard and fatherboard of what you're brought up with is as defining as genetics. And I'm talking out my ass, but it sounds right, doesn't it? Yeah. This is, as I said earlier, Moon and I, you know, kind of regroup a little, talk a little about, you know, back in the day when we were together and how that sort of ended up, and then kind of got into the groove of just talking about her great new book. It's a very poetic and honest memoir about her life growing up in the very unique and singular world of the Zappa household. But also it deals with a lot of stuff that anybody can experience when you have, you know, parents that aren't quite parents for one reason or another. The book is called Earth to Moon. It is a memoir, as I said, and it comes out next week, August 20th. You can pre-order it now. This is me talking to Moon Zappa, the amazing Moon Zappa.
Manchmal willst du einfach nur ans Meer. Oder durch die Straßen einer lebendigen Stadt schlendern. Oder endlich den Moment genießen. Einfach die Welt mit TUI neu erleben. Mit TUI reist du so, wie du willst. Als Familie, zu zweit oder einfach allein. Flexibel, sicher und immer mit dem guten Gefühl, dass jemand da ist, wenn es drauf ankommt. Gestalte mit TUI Urlaub ganz nach deinen Wünschen. Überall im Reisebüro, auf tui.com und in der App.
Diese Folge wird euch präsentiert von Tinder. Ich bin mir relativ sicher, wenn du mir hier zuhörst, dass du genauso wie ich auch so eine Schwachstelle für diese ganzen romantischen BookTok-Bücher hast. Zwei Menschen lernen sich kennen, sie mögen sich am Anfang noch nicht, aber dann verlieben die sich natürlich. Mein Vorschlag wäre jetzt aber, dass du deine ganz persönliche Love-Story in deinem echten Leben einfach selber schreibst und das mit Tinder. Bei Tinder findest du nämlich genau das, wonach du suchst, sei es die ganz große Liebe, sei es ein unverbindliches Treffen oder vielleicht möchtest du auch einfach nur neue Menschen kennenlernen. Also, schreibe dein eigenes romantisches Buch und starte dein nächstes Kapitel mit Tinder jetzt downloaden.
Hi, this is Sherelle Dorsey from TED Tech, and this episode is brought to you by Solidigm. The world runs on data, and data relies on storage. But most businesses rarely think about how crucial that storage really is. The truth is, it's no longer just a commodity. With new demands and constraints, especially from AI, the old ways of managing data are holding innovation back. Solid-state storage from Solidigm is changing that. It helps reduce energy use, shrink physical footprints, and accelerate data at the edge, unlocking more from your AI infrastructure. Learn more at whatsthestateofyourstorage.com.
You got notes?
I do have notes in case, because I have, you know, short-term memory, and I'm just like, what am I here to do again?
What is your short-term? What are you here to do again? Are we, were you nervous?
Was I nervous?
Coming over here?
Well,
I haven't seen you in a long time.
I haven't seen you in a long time, so this is the first time we've seen each other since our breakup.
Uh-huh.
And,
The abrupt breakup on my part was pretty clean.
Yeah, it was clean.
And I think that...
You were so direct, and so I did very little grieving because of how
well, we didn't have a chance.
It so thoroughly, so cleanly.
The possibility of post, like, I've never really, I was relatively, I thought it was the right thing to do, but I've never been that clean about it. But in thinking about, like, I didn't know if I was going to get to read the book, but I knew I had to read some of it. So I started at Frank's cancer diagnosis and read that. And then I'm like, oh, I got to read that. Because there was part of me that's sort of like, she should have opened with this, with the death. But
I could have used your notes early on, Mark. It's a bit late now.
Yeah. No, there's no notes. It's great. It's written great. I love it. You do a thing that I love. I'm a big fan of the poetry of things. So, like I'm good with, like, what's in the bedroom, all the stuff, because I think that has a great effect.
I tried to treat it like I was writing sci-fi, and...
what does that mean?
Well, to put the reader in a world and just kind of also write it sort of like a police report. So I tried to be as neutral as possible. I mean, I still think there's some nudging.
Well, I mean, it's thorough, but it's still your point of view. And what I found interesting about it, but wait, I want to, before we do this, let's clear the air, which is not even that dirty, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
So the cleanness of the breakup, I remember is you calling me a couple of days after I said, I can't do it anymore. And you said, well, your bike is here in your sneakers. And I said, throw them away.
Right. And some of the issues that we had were things like,
brutal, dude.
Can you get rid of that mattress that you've slept on with every single person who's ever come before me? And you're like, what if I asked you to do that? I go, I would get a new mattress. And this was completely just not an option.
I still have the mattress.
That's disgusting.
It's in the guest room, but it's a good mattress.
Well, here's the thing. That's you loving nostalgia and the memories.
That's not true. I don't even think of it that way. I don't even attach it to that. Right now, last place that Lynn was ill. It was in that guest room, but that's the only thing attached to it. Like, I don't look at mattresses and think like, nah, I did a lot of work on that one. Yeah, it doesn't even register that way. It wasn't nostalgia.
And it certainly wasn't make partner feel comfortable. I'll tell you that.
Well, I'll take it, but let's just be honest about the type of chaos we were in.
Yep.
I mean, I've read the book, and I realize that we both gravitate towards chaos a little bit. But we were coming out of, both of us, like barely out of the worst relationships of our lives.
The worst ever. Although I've had a worse one since, but yes.
What?
Yeah, I know. Can you believe it?
How could it be worse than that? Well, also, like, you know, I only heard, you know, the interesting thing about reading about your family and Frank and Gail is that, like, whatever that yoga guy was, I mean, you at that time had really, you know, described him as this messianic character. And I'm like, I don't know him. Who the fuck is that guy? you had given him these magic powers. I'm like, that guy?
I know. That was super helpful. The other thing the golden nuggets I walked away with from our time together was the love of an electric toothbrush.
Oh, yeah. Sonicare.
Yep.
The first Sonicares. That must have been like back in the day.
That was pleasurable. The commitment to fitness.
Yes.
That was really fun. The partner running. I really enjoyed that.
Yep.
I haven't found anyone else who likes to do that, but that's okay. There was something else that was... Oh, shame. You had a book on your nightstand.
Yeah, that guy that... what's that guy's name who wrote that book on shame? Yeah.
And I literally did not understand shame at all.
Oof.
And then when I read that
really?
Book...
You're soaking in it.
Exactly. It's so close to me, I can't see it.
Oh, my God. It becomes your entire engine.
Definitely.
And it's only because of that stuff that... You know, since, but I do, I want to make some sort of amends. But the thing was, is that my relationship that I was coming out of was crazy.
Yeah.
To the point where, you know, you had to, you know, convince me to get a restraining order and that kind of stuff. And I had never experienced the type of self erasure or codependency in me until that.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're like completely vigilant. Always, apparently, after reading the book. But you know, there was some missteps, obviously. But I just think from where I was, I couldn't, and I don't seem like the kind of guy that is like that, but I really couldn't hold myself together, you know, in light of, you know, the tornado of you and whatever I was trying to do.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair to this other person, I felt so bad for you for what you were sharing about your experience, that was a suggestion. I'm glad you didn't take it because
which one?
The restraining order.
Yeah,
because
I eventually did.
Oh my God, I missed that chapter.
No, you missed it. And it wasn't like, you know, I don't really. It was really not. I do a bit about it, which, and I think you'd appreciate it in that the issue when you have. And I've fought this part of me for so long that, you know, because I don't really see myself as a people pleaser, but I do want to maintain a certain amount of sanity and things. So I will, but for some reason, if someone's persistent, you know, I'll eventually give in. And the thrust of the bit is really that, like, I didn't take a restraining order out because I thought she would hurt me. I took it out because I was afraid I'd get back together with her, that I needed to get law enforcement involved because of my lack of boundaries. but it eventually worked itself out.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't want to, you know, sit here and talk over you.
No. It's an interesting thing to, I mean, so my book basically is the map for how I arrive at poor boundaries myself and how I arrive at allowing unacceptable things in my life.
Yeah.
And I knew that before I decided to write the book, I felt like I can either be a cautionary tale about succumbing to the victimization I felt. You know, where do you go when your mother's your first bully? That's not a great start.
Yeah.
Or I could, for myself, say, well, I'm going to fight through it, and I'm going to let love win, and I'm going to be a role model for myself of victory over my history.
How's that working?
I have to climb that mountain every single day because the damage is real, you know?
I know.
I'm tearing up thinking about it. It's so.
I know you do. When I'm reading it, you know, there's part of me that's sort of like, she must be so tired.
I am. That's why I say that sentence a lot. I am so tired.
Yeah. But I do want to apologize for one thing that I think. And but you're not giving me your side of this. Was your experience in retrospect in investigation, which you have clearly done through most of your life, and left names of relationships? I'm not in there, which is good, I guess. But do you? But how do you frame that in your mind, the experience we had? Because it was fairly short and it was intense. And we were both like brutally ripped open the whole time.
Right. For me, it didn't feel short because I'd known you for so many years. And so I thought it was going to be like one of those like, and after 20 years,
yeah, me too.
But my mother had just been diagnosed with cancer.
Right.
And at that time, I didn't realize what was going to come with her illness.
Right.
And I am really private about the stuff that hits me on a deep, deep, deep level.
Mm.
So the things I included in the book are I have perspective on because it's – and some of the stuff is just hilarious.
Yeah.
Because whatever, you see the setup for – how I end up in those situations.
Right.
And
right.
I hope that those stories deliver. And I think the reader will be like, get out of that room.
Yeah.
Well,
the thing I wanted to apologize for was that, you know, it was the first time your mother went to the hospital. And my misassumption, I remember because, you know, I didn't go to the hospital and my niece was in town and I remember it. And we had you were upset that I wouldn't come to the hospital. But in my mind, like, I didn't feel like I had a place because your family was going to be there. And now I really read about the family and I'm like, oh my God, I really left her hanging.
Yeah.
So I do want to apologize for that.
Thank you.
Because I prioritized whatever, you know, my niece was there or whatever. I was like, she's got her whole family and I don't know them. That was my thinking. I'm just going to be like, I'm going to draw attention because I'm not part of this inner circle really. And I'm sorry.
Thank you. Appreciate that. I really do.
Yeah. But in terms of the rest of it, for whatever reason, it was not because I had no love for you. I just couldn't handle what you were going through.
Yeah.
And what you...
I mean, I statements are so much more helpful. I can't handle what you're going through, so I can't show up for you. Would have been a much nicer thing to say, even though it's still terrible.
What, you mean at that moment?
At any moment, to just speak from an I place of just saying, this is my limitation, or this is my fear.
Right.
This is my,
but
because I can work with that. A person can work with something like that.
But I'm not unlike you, and I think that both of us are working against our true self interests to maintain sanity for others or to
absolutely.
Do whatever.
Absolutely, for me to find what I need.
Yeah.
Is impossible. It's spelunking in the dark.
Yeah, totally.
Being dropped. I can't find myself because I'm so. I mean, I was basically raised to be a lady butler. I should have been somebody's personal assistant.
Well, what's amazing about the book, and I've been thinking about it a lot because I do love it. It does make me. The police report analogy is sort of correct to me because there is a certain amount of. Diplomatically and honestly and with the correct amount of respect and emotion, settling scores here, right?
Oh, that's interesting.
I mean, I wrote a book, Attempting Normal, where I'd really take my dad to task with a certain amount of love. But in retrospect, he got very upset and, he thought it would affect him and his life legally somehow. And like there was a phone call from him and he was like, the whole family's mad about that. And I'm like, all right, well, it's my experience as well. He goes, well, I'm mad. I'm like, well, what do you want, money? and he goes, yeah. And he goes, and I'm like, all right, well, how much do you want? He goes, $100,000. I said, I'll give you $5,000.
Oh my God.
But it didn't matter. I'm fine with him. But I guess my point is, like, I didn't know after all of it and looking back on the writing, was it done in good faith? Was I not being spiteful? Did I not do that to as a fuck you, you know?
I mean, I definitely had a fuck you draft that I wrote.
Oh.
And then I worked really hard to take the fire out. And,
yeah.
And I also had to consciously not put stories in that I really thought there'd be a revolt if people read it. I feel like they would have just been like...
By being honest about your side of it.
Yeah, like if I went further and really told some of the really painful stuff. I mean, I pressed
there.
On the bruise as much as I could.
Yeah,
and I left out some stuff that was, I think, would just not be
good.
Wise. Yeah.
Well, here's what I was going to say is that. The stuff you're talking about in terms of what you struggle with as a person with, you know, difficult parents or inattentive or emotionally abusive or negligent, you know, is a common thing. You know, I deal with it. But what's interesting about your life is that you have these issues, but no one grew up like you in the world.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
It's like because there's this element of it where it's almost like a – not like a novel, but because of the public personness of you and your family, you know, you have an idea of these people. It's not just like the mom that no one knows who did this to me that I got to get through. They all of a sudden you have to weigh, you know, your perception of these people.
Yeah. I mean, I really did feel like we were raised like we were royals or the Kennedys or
yeah.
So I had to there was a public me, a get along with the family me,
yeah,
and then a private me that was just in turmoil.
Well, I remember the one time I have some very funny moments, mostly involving Moby, who I can't, I just can't.
And okay.
I don't even know if you noticed it, but what. The one time I went to the house was for that Christmas party.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of the royalty thing, you know, I definitely had the feeling because of the nature of a lot of the guests, I'm like, this is a dying royal family situation.
That was at my family's home.
Yes.
And
it was that was the only time I met Gail.
Bagpipers and
trees.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like, you know, a very odd bunch of guests. And it felt like, you know, is this entering the Grey Gardens phase of the Zappa dynasty?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was it? It kind of was.
Absolutely.
But when you took me downstairs, it was me and Moby and you, and you're showing me the studios, and that fucker got on every goddamn instrument, and I was like, stop it! Like, any room we walked into. We walked into your dad's old studio, and he immediately is like, blank, 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 on the piano. I'm like, what are you doing?
The funny thing I remember about that tour was that... I don't remember if it was you or Moby who said it. I said, oh, that's new. I haven't seen that before. And then you or Moby said, how can you tell? Because there was just so much
I just
hoarding.
Remember the one room with like literally two toilets at different levels around the corner, 5 feet away from each other.
Gail had intended for there to be a bathroom where a parent and child could
go to the bathroom
pee and poop
at the same time?
Together. But it was built long after... the children needed that size toilet.
Yeah.
So.
And I just remember you showed me Gail's room and it was like this kind of like a monastery.
Yeah.
It was like, so it was different than the whole house.
Mm-hmm.
And it definitely felt like, yeah, no, we can't go in there.
I find it weird when people let you go into their bedroom unless you also share that bedroom. I find going into people's bedrooms really weird.
I notice that with people in general. If I show someone the house, like I don't really register it, but I register. They're like, no, I'm good. I don't need to go in there with the, you know, I guess it is sort of a secret space.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay.
Well, it's where intimacy takes place.
Yeah.
Like sleeping and being with a partner.
But the other thing with the book that I think is interesting is that, you know, you're looking at all this childhood stuff as a person that has spent her life evaluating their self and why they are their self. So you bring this information that you now know to all of these moments that, you know, because they're pieces of a puzzle of you.
Yeah, I felt like I was always solving a cold case on my own, or it was an all-white puzzle.
Yeah.
With none of the edge pieces.
Yeah. The stifling, you know, of your, that whole idea of, like, if your parents don't, you know, kind of seal the lid on your sense of self by giving you the space to build one, it's fucked.
It's fucked.
Yeah. Did you ever read that Firestone book? Had I read that when I knew you?
Which one?
The Fantasy Bond?
No.
Oh, my God.
Definitely going to get that. I am loving, by the way, Prince Harry's book.
Oh, really?
Spare. Yeah. Excellent. Excellent. Fascinating.
A similar family situation?
Honestly, yes. Honestly, yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah. It's really interesting.
So let's pick up where we left off.
Yep.
What, like, after Gail passed, that the stuff at the end of the book, you know, what it, because it's not police reporting. It's very, you know, emotional and sort of like whether or not you feel like you've gotten to the point in yourself to where you're really exposing, you know, the heart of things, the dynamic of the family around both deaths is all there. Mm-hmm. You know, in like the scene at the cemetery with Gail, Gail's funeral is devastating.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, you know, those moments with your siblings, it's just like, it's fucking crazy. And it's beyond anything I can understand in terms of family.
I worry that the reader will be like, this can't be. Like, they won't be able,
they won't. You read the rest of the book, it makes perfect sense. There's no, like, you're not going to be like, what is happening? How is this family like this?
Yeah, I think the other thing about my family and I think it's rare when somebody's final word sets you on a course of just total self-inquiry and it's horror. And to have to overcome to be bigger than death, which is already a topic that people can't deal with, mortality anyway. I think that was that's one thing I think is so weird about my life. That's really bizarre to me and I hope that in writing this book, if anybody ever has to go through something like that or have to have a reckoning with somebody's final word, it's hard. It's really hard.
What was hers?
Well, basically that she doesn't wish me well forever.
Yeah.
I mean, that's terrible.
Yeah. The weird thing about you and in terms of my experience or knowing you on and off for a long time is, and it's the same with me because I don't see it either, is that I see you. You're not your self is stronger than you think because, you know, you insist on it. And people who are shattered, who don't insist on being reckoned with, they float. I mean, you may float, but, you know, you're making things, you're making tea, you're doing stuff. So all that is an effort of self that makes it fairly present. And it's odd to me that all the talk of not having stuff. I feel that way too, but I do know that myself is in there. It's just a very young.
Yeah.
And
I'm super stunted in so many areas.
Right.
But the thing about me is, When I find an area where I'm super stunted, I then go, who's the best at this thing? Because I want to learn from that motherfucker.
Yeah, but like, who the fuck are they? And like,
you go searching for those people.
And I know, but how are ultimately, you know, it's like the Wizard of Oz. Eventually you're going to be like, oh, it's just that guy.
Totally.
Right?
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, I read the one chapter where you realize that, you know, your guru at that time was just a racket. you know, but like I guess it's fortunate. I never had that. I never, you know, when I get down to that part of myself, you know, I'm sort of like, all right. So the one thing I learned is like, if when you're raging and it's coming from an emotional place of, you know, a 7-year-old, you know, that coming out of a 50-year-old man is abusive and awful.
Yeah.
That intensity. So it's like, so stop that. So that was what I learned from Firestone, which is just a book, and I'm not even sure I understood the book. And it's that if you have emotionally abusive or negligent parents, you know, you, and this is all through your book, is that if you feel awkward and fucked up, you can only blame yourself.
Well, if you
because
blame
your parents, your parents.
But also, if you blame yourself, then something might change. If I can be different than I am, then something externally will change. And that's kind of like...
That's an idea.
It's an idea that never delivers.
No, because what you do is you put a shitty parent in your head because your parents are what they are.
Absolutely.
And so that parent, that doesn't change until you change that, whatever that is.
And that is the hardest job in the world. And that's the mountain I climb every day because I've internalized what was the worst of what.
You have an inner shitty parent.
I have an inner shitty parent.
Yeah. And like, but like, do you find that you're making, because I find that like I know usually when, you know, that one's telling me what to do, I'm like, well, we're not going to do that.
I'm building that, that muscle. I work with, finally, I found an amazing, amazing, amazing therapist.
Yeah.
And she teaches really practical techniques like, number one, just notice if you're dysregulated. Oh, I'm dysregulated all day long. And then when you get dysregulated and you notice it, then you could try the 5-4-3-2-1 calm down, which is 5 things I can see, 4 things I can hear, 3 things I can feel, 2 things I can smell, 1 thing I can taste.
Yeah.
And you calm yourself through your senses.
Yeah.
And because as you figure out which sense you need to pay more attention to, it just naturally
calms you down.
You simmer down. You just simmer down.
Oh, I think about it.
It's a new muscle.
It works?
It's hard, but I'm retraining my brain.
I'm just being in Vancouver by myself and, you know, away from my routines. I've been thinking a lot, and I'm still sort of like most of what I think about is food and nicotine because I'm on and off nicotine. Now I'm on these pouches, it's okay. It's okay if what I need to do immediately when I land anywhere is go to a Whole Foods. It's okay.
Yeah.
If that's what's going to, you know, put me in a level place, fine. Yeah. Go look at food.
Right.
Fuck it.
Absolutely.
But like the times where nothing's going on, ugh, it's squirrely, dude.
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, that was the other thing, too. You were the only person I've ever dated who had a temper equal to my own.
That's because of what I went through was scary to me. And it could have gotten bad.
Yeah, I was really grateful because I was like, oh, this is what people feel like opposite me. And this is shitty. And I thought we could solve it together and just be like, hey, could you say that another way? Or, hey, let's talk about it when we can both be calm. Or I really had high hopes for the potential of working through the same or similar.
There was so much going on.
I mean,
Matilda was like, what, 8 or 9?
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it was like... And then there was that weird, because when I went into that with you, I'm like, all right, let's do this right. I shouldn't really meet the kid for a few months. And like within 3 days, like, hey, here's my kid. And then I fucking meet her dad for whatever reason in the front yard. And he pulls me aside. He's like, I'm good with this. I'm like, what? It's been a month and a half. What is happening?
Yeah, I wish I had known more about insecure attachment. When we met, then I would.
What is
like,
that?
What is that?
What does that mean?
Well, if you had somebody that was like outright abusive, you have a better chance in being relationships because it'd be like, oh, there's that thing I refuse to have in my life. But when there's a little bit of something good and a little bit of something terrible, that's the hardest thing to navigate.
Sure, because you think the terrible will go away, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
They're like, well, they can do the good, so they must be able to shrink the bad.
Yeah. Yeah. But do you find that in yourself as well?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. But it's hard to see your blind spots. You need to be in it.
You get so angry over just think like if you were cooking and I'd say something like I know, you know.
So. Yeah. Yeah. I had no idea how I just didn't know how to self-soothe. I was completely blind to that.
So when you're writing this book. Because I haven't really talked to you. And the other thing I remember about you is there was a never-ending text flow of adages. I'm like,
that's my version of Whole Foods.
All day long, just sort of like quotes from everybody.
Because they were reminders for me of like what was and what is possible.
Yeah.
So I was like, wait, this is what health looks like. Other people think these kinds of things. I'm not thinking these kinds of things. I'd love to think these kinds of things. Then I wouldn't have to send these kinds of things.
Yeah. I guess I relate to that, but I don't. I obsess about that kind of stuff. But as life goes on, you realize, don't you, that no one's doing it quite right.
Well, everyone's doing it to their own temperament and interest and whatever. It's rare. Compatibility is super rare.
Not just compatibility, but like how...
Or acceptance of other, super rare.
Acceptance of self is not so rare, but when you don't have it, it's a fucking nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
So when... Because I haven't known where you've been. I know you spent time in Taos, and I don't know what your life has been, but when do you get like... the strength or the wherewithal to sort of take this on? Because you've written other books and we've talked about your childhood, but you really must have felt a moment where you like, either I'm going to purge this or I'm going to process it or I'm going to, you know, what is it? What was the moment where you're like, where you felt it was okay? Because you're, for whatever you say, look, my relationship with my parents is like, it's, you know, I say they're people I grew up with. They're not, that mm-hmm. had problems. Mm-hmm. I never felt any real maternal or so I don't feel the attachment that most people have. Like I can't relate to, you know, feeling like I owe them anything, which is a gift. But at some point you had to reckon, you know, with this, you know, how kind of programmed you were to.
Well, I just hit a limit where I just thought, when's it my turn? When do I get to have the reciprocity? When do I get to be seen and loved and accepted like I see and love and accept all of you in spite of your many, 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 many underlined boldface, many horrible qualities? You know, I just thought that everyone was going to do the all for one, one for all kind of a thing.
Well, I get that. But what's interesting is that like over the course of the whole book, you know, even if you know who Frank is or you're a fan of Frank's, and most people don't really know Gail, but they, even with your need to respect what they were and who they were, they don't come off good. You know, there's no...
Well, I really tried hard to have them come off well.
I know.
And to say these are their qualities and I accept
right.
them.
It doesn't feel vindictive.
Yeah.
Because you're just documenting your experience.
Yeah.
But they were, in those beats where people, a couple of beats in the book where people think you're being abused one way or the other and you don't see it.
I didn't see it.
But it was like, it was total insanity. That they were not... They were awful, awful parents.
Well, it's a pyramid, and my dad was at the top of the pyramid.
I get it.
And all arrows pointed toward the top of the pyramid.
The non-communicative, what's the word I want? Insulated.
Yeah, no, I should probably be in jail, but with my rage about feeling so gypped in the family department. But I'm not blaming them. They
were what they were, but
right.
But also the weird thing about having lack of boundaries and a certain amount of freedom on certain levels is you do find your own parameters, right? And at some point, I think in the book too, I mean, you at some point realize like, well, these are the things I got that are okay, and these are the things I got that are, you know, damaging to me.
Yeah, I didn't wrap it up with a bow at the end. I definitely feel like
I didn't finish the book going like,
yeah,
she's okay.
Yeah. No, I mean, the thing is these things have a lasting effect. And again, I wrote the book hoping that if I can give words to these kinds of feelings and situations, that somebody who has it as bad or worse than I do,
yeah,
they can navigate a little bit better and get to loving themselves faster than I did.
Yeah,
and it's I think it really is about mirror neurons and seeing other examples that you can strive for.
Yeah,
I would always be baffled by, wait, they had a family dinner, they sat at a table. Like, I still barely have managed
when you go to other people's houses.
Yeah,
yeah.
I've still barely managed to have sit down meals with my own child, who's my favorite person in the world. My dad was my favorite.
Yeah.
And now my kid is, you
yeah
know? And it's just That's just, that's...
I think it's great that it also works as a sort of like a document of a time.
Yeah, yeah.
And there are certain things that, you know, people who came up during that time kind of mythologize about music and about the scene that, you know, but it becomes pretty clear that like that the Zappa House was its own scene outside of whatever was going on in a way.
Definitely. And then the other thing that's interesting to me about my life is because I feel like we were raised to be thinking like Kennedys or Royals.
Yeah.
That we I always felt like I couldn't let the public down and end up in rehab or do something to be that was unbecoming that would affect my family.
Yeah.
Or because so many people would get LLCs in my name,
yeah,
start businesses with my name. And so I felt instead of going, hey, that's my name.
Yeah.
Like a normal person.
Oh, like
would,
that baby store.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just kept thinking, well, they're trying to get their lives together. I better make sure that I don't mar their chance at a life. That's lunacy. But the other piece of it, the other side of it is that I didn't end up in rehab. Like,
well, none of you are druggies,
but my
right?
point is, yeah, it wasn't just, I mean, I didn't even allow myself to go down that road,
yeah,
to see maybe I'm a big stoner or something. And I'm not acting out. I'm not finding out about it or whatever.
Yeah.
I there were so many things I didn't let myself go through, like that normal.
You're the opposite. You're the companion piece to the drug addict.
But so there's this, I feel like my life has been in reaction to,
yeah,
and then finally I'm now like, well, actually, but who am I if I'm not doing the thing or doing the opposite of the thing?
Yeah.
What would I do if there was none of that?
And what are you finding?
I'm experimenting right now.
Yeah. Well, that the other part of the book that was, and I should have talked about it, about death and mortality and grief and, you know, how people react to it. Because that was another component of my reaction to when Gail was sick. Like they avoid it. My mother avoids it. Yeah, I remember she would, you know, she doesn't want me to go to funerals. She doesn't, and now, you know, she's not in good shape. But you took at some sort of bizarro anatomy class,
yeah,
where you were like, I couldn't even quite wrap my brain around the context of this this autopsy class.
Well, I really wanted to. I mean, I really had to rebuild what is a person from the ground up. After my mother basically said, in summation of knowing you, eh.
Yeah, but everything leading up to that was, you know, she was a threatened, fucked up, you know.
But I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I accepted her. And then she steals forgiveness from me because she doesn't tell me everything she's done.
Yeah.
And that is that's one of the biggest cruelties also, to ask for forgiveness but not tell you everything that she's done.
Right.
Because...
Do they ever, any parent?
Be not given, I mean, the chance. That was stolen from me. My forgiveness was stolen.
Right. And I think that's, you know...
And my ability to grieve her, therefore, was stolen.
Right.
I have to grieve a different thing.
Right, that whatever she gave you, which was not even half of it.
It's not that. It's that the basic idea of we're all in this together was was like the stated motto of the family, but it was not put into action.
Right, and like in the book throughout, you realize that she, you know, was paranoid, threatened, vindictive. So whatever the all in and together was, is she had built a situation where you guys were fortressed, you know, out of her emotional liabilities to believe that you were a fighting unit of some kind, but not a family unit.
Right.
Right.
A family business.
Yeah. More it became that.
But well, we were always signing documents that were related to the family business.
But the fact that she, you know,
like who makes your kid sign legal documents from the time you can, you know, hold a pen? That's not yeah, great.
The whole thing is very interesting and very upsetting. But like for me, in terms of family, reading about how she just, you know, iced out all of Frank's family,
yeah,
for and they didn't seem like bad people.
Yeah.
For what, and you have no reason. There's no reason. So that stuff is crazy.
Yeah.
But what was it after she died? Like, the thing about the, like, I'm talking about my dad has a dementia now, and I tell people that, you know, the filter's gone. And before they get too far gone, you know, the statute of limitations on what they should and shouldn't tell their kids is gone. Mm-hmm. So, like, if you're curious and you want some answers, you know, it's time to go fishing.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
But you're never going to get all of it, right?
No, of course not. Do you think that you didn't end up following a guru because you had the you were raised Jewish, where you were fundamentally questioning, and there was the chance to be
thinking and I don't think so. No, because it turns out that, you know, I don't even know that my mother talks about anything. Mm. My mother is like totally emotionally stunted and not. You know, my brother, because my brother's dealing with her down in Florida, she doesn't have dementia, but she just, neither one of them were that curious, really. I mean, she was an artist. But I think my thing is, it's like, for whatever reason, yeah, I never thought that God or spirituality were answers for me. My brother, on the other hand, was a real searcher and was, you know, became more Jewish, you know, was running around hugging people because of Leo Buscaglia when he was a kid. You know, he needed this thing. And even to this day, I'm like, I don't find that I have that, you know, that's going to make me whole or better. And I don't really believe too many people about anything.
What about being of service?
That I can do.
Yeah. I mean, isn't that a form of spirituality?
I guess so. I mean, I'm just saying in terms of like the guru or having some sort of wisdom, like I'll take it. Mm-hmm. And if I read things, I'm like, I can use that.
Yeah.
But I don't crave it.
I remember when you saw a photo of me and Laura Dern and Swami Satchidananda, and you were just like, oh my God, this is one of the saddest photos I've ever seen. And it was so, I mean, you really did have some real clarity on some things that I was still, as they say, what stays in vagueness? No, yeah, what is yeah. it?
What happens in Vegas?
Yeah,
stays
what,
in Vegas?
What happens in vagueness yes. stays in vagueness.
Yeah.
And I have so many situations that I was, whatever, magical thinking. I was just doing my best and I thought that was just optimism, magical thinking. I didn't realize that it was...
Yeah.
A liability and a detriment. Like, I wish I had no hope.
Yeah.
Almost there.
Yeah.
Thanks, political climate.
Yeah. I wrote something recently. It said, hope is a placeholder. And to me, it's not that I don't have or have hope, but I...
What's it a placeholder for? What should be there?
Existential terror.
Right.
It's a, you know, yeah. it's a Band-Aid.
It's a sidestep. You're right. That's true.
And as is most things.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
You know,
feel the actual thing in its raw form.
It's terrible.
It feels bad.
Really bad.
It feels really bad. But if you feel it, then you can let some of it go. That's really the only way.
Yeah, because I can't attribute anything to, like, I do feel a little better. I know I've made mistakes and I've done, I try to, you know, I think sobriety helped, but I think it was that Ernest Becker book, really, that denial of death. I think that's, if anything, is what, like, really, the idea that people's need to believe is almost genetic.
Mm.
And that need for community and to somehow feel part of something bigger than yourself in order to kind of keep the existential terror at bay is almost as normal as eating.
Mm-hmm.
But it is an act of the mind. And I thought that to me just revealed something about the nature of belief and looking outside yourself that I think kind of broke my brain forever in
right.
a good way.
I want to read it. But I think also it is through the body that we
process.
Yeah,
you did a lot
process.
Of body work. Yeah, I don't do that, and I carry a lot of shit, and I do wonder.
But exercise,
about that.
Dance,
yeah,
any movement, swimming,
sure,
just to say, I'm going to feel terror right now. I'm going to feel my fear of my mortality. I'm going to make shapes with my body and say, what does it feel like?
Yeah.
What does it look like? And that's one way to just start processing it.
But I also believe that I am in a, you know, a fairly profound amount of a denial. So don't look to me like, you know, like that I just because I don't have that stuff, I am coming up against my age and everything else. And
well, rigorous honesty is another super important.
Yeah, because I think that can get you in your body.
Yeah.
You know, at least you can own yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And going back to the anatomy thing, it's like I really wanted to see what we're all made of. What is the universal thing that we are all are? And I wanted to physically hold our organs.
Well, what kind of class was that? You sign up for it? I mean, that was the interesting thing. Is there a place I can go and just just kind of hold organs?
I'll tell you after we get up here.
I don't know if I want to do it, but I mean, how did you seek that out? Where was
that? Because I was teaching yoga. Okay. And so as part of yoga training, you can take anatomy classes and then further your anatomy lessons by taking a course where you're with a
body.
A body that's been donated to science.
Mm. Was it, they seemed a little worn out, those bodies.
You do, one was fresh.
Yeah,
and one was used. That's how they do it. So you can see the body in different stages of decay.
And how did that whole thing work for you?
Well, between that and going to Burning Man and seeing the amplification of love, that 1-2 punch, and how novelty really puts you in the present. And if you have any trauma, you know, you're just replaying that brain groove. So to do things that are just so heightened, amplified in the opposite direction, doing those two things back to back, I think really helped me see, it just reset my system, the same as cold plunges and certain kinds of breathing techniques, like James Nestor's Breath, that book.
Yeah.
That is a game changer.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, I do. I hold my breath. Yeah.
And just noticing throughout the day, same with dysregulation. I breathe basically into my clavicles. That's it. And I have to remember to breathe all the way down into the rest of myself.
Yeah.
So.
I don't know. Like, I feel like.
Training yourself to feel is difficult.
Yeah,
to stay in your body if you've dissociated to survive.
I feel like at some point I just kind of put a lid on it, and I think at some point I was sort of like, I can accept, you know, who I am with whatever limitations I have and with whatever liabilities I have. Like, because I think the in talking about. Not like I was told that a parent's responsibility, if they're good at some point, is to kind of, you know, nurture you and then let you make mistakes so you can figure out the parameters of your sense of self, you know, as opposed to, you know, make you an appendage,
right?
Or just panic all the time,
right?
And coming back to this, I think there's some part that if you don't have a lid on your sense of self. I mean, it's like you're going to be looking to the universe for parenting for the rest of your life.
Well, yeah. I mean, apparently the ingredients is are roots and wings. You know, the rooting of feeling safe in your home, safe.
Yeah.
Then you can. There's a place to go, and then knowing that you can always return to that safety, but that safety is the thing that gives you the liftoff.
Right. Yeah,
because then you get to fly on your own, and you know, you come back and back, and then when you're, I think there's a developmental stage called object constancy when you're, I think like two or something.
Yeah,
you're supposed
to
be able to. Your parents stay put, and then you go and crawl away and travel, and then they're out of view, and then you crawl back, and then they stay where they are, so that you know that that's safe, that you can go and come back, and you develop that process, and if I received objects constantly instead of object constancy.
Yeah.
and they would walk away. And so you're just it's a constant state of disorientation.
Yeah, and panic.
Panic.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not a great start.
Yeah, if you don't have the roots and the wings, you're just falling.
Yeah, exactly. Endlessly falling. The movie Gravity, I think I had to stay in the theater 20 extra minutes just being like, that's how I feel, except I never landed.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm still falling now. Yeah. So what, in doing this, because I found when I wrote anything that, you know, there is a sense of discovery that happens when you write.
Yes.
You know, where you're like, oh my God, you know, like, because mm-hmm. it just comes out in that different way. I mean, how do you, and I appreciate the fact that you used the word cock and not dick.
It's sexier.
I think so. Yep. But like, you know, it's like I made that change years ago. It's a cock. It's not a dick. But I mean, today, you know, having written this book, and what's going on with you and the siblings? Nothing?
Oh, no. I just went and saw Sebastian Bach and Santa Ana with Amit the other night.
You did?
Yeah, because I look for the places where there's the Venn diagram overlap and how I can stay connected to them in the ways that they're available.
Yeah.
And because connection is important to me. And it's, you know, I have to do a little check-in with myself, like, how do I feel today about the stuff that's unacceptable? And then I'm like, well, we see it differently.
Has all the legal stuff settled down?
Oh, yeah. All the legal stuff is done.
And do you have a relationship with the other two?
Dweezil won't speak to me.
You don't know why?
No. And, I mean, I do know why.
Oh.
I suspect, rather. I can't. He's unwilling to sit down and have an actual conversation. I reach out probably at least once a year and say, ready yet?
Yeah.
We doing this? Because it's to me.
It gets crazy getting old.
It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
But they, that's his choice.
Right.
And if that makes him feel better,
yeah,
then of course I'm all for it. With my sister, I wish I was closer.
Yeah. Sorry.
It's okay.
Because like when we were together for that time, like everybody was still pretty tight.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that all came unhinged. But in writing, like how do you find that, how did it change your perception of your parents?
Well, a couple of things happened. One was I did end up having more empathy for Gail because when I would look at all the tour dates, when I did, you know,
a little bit of
research, I was like, good Lord, she was there with one of us. She was there with two of us, and she was there with three. Then she was there with four of us, and he was doing this. You know, it's
like a year at a time sometimes?
Yeah, at least 9 months. Yeah. And then all the financial stress, and then literally having a business in the house. So every surface was...
With Barking Pumpkin.
Barking Pumpkin,
yeah.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
And so I think she was just on a runaway train.
Yeah.
In a lot of cases.
But when you look at your own sort of, like... There are certain things that I imagine you see that you got from her that aren't necessarily bad, but like in reading how you perceive them now, you know, with her sort of kind of random spirituality, rich witchcraft, this and that.
Her convenient spirituality.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That, you know, it's hard to, you know, do you ever, because of that, I mean— do you question your own sort of craving for it all?
Of course I do. It's in some ways it's a connection to happy memories.
Right.
Which is so sad that that's the happy memory. You know what I mean? So, you know, flipping through some book about whatever. Yeah.
Yeah.
Druids or something.
Yeah,
I'm like, that's what I remember.
Yeah.
She took us to Stonehenge. That was amazing.
So... you're able to empathize with her as a person that was constantly overwhelmed and in crisis.
Yeah, I mean, I saw her as broken growing up.
Right.
And then I just never thought it would get turned on me. I don't know why. I just didn't think that she would turn that on me. And then with my dad, I really saw him as a little autistic or something undiagnosed, because
right.
he definitely did not know how to really show up for other sufficiently.
Emotionally but, for anybody.
Right.
Seems.
And so, he was still the funniest, smartest, most interesting person.
Sure.
And he was so himself that there's something weird and amazing about being opposite somebody who's like, this is me.
Yeah.
Take it or leave it.
Right.
Because then you there's when you hit an edge, then you can be like, oh, how am I with this edge? It's a very weird thing.
Yeah, and also like I noticed too that in a book that is so personal about self-assessment that, and also the assessment in terms of emotional assessment, psychological assessment of family, you don't use any diagnosis.
Right.
Like it almost seems on purpose.
Because it's not my job and I'm not a therapist.
But even for yourself.
Because
people throw around labels all the time.
Yeah.
Narcissistic, borderline.
Yeah, like. I try to not do that because at the end of the day, it's how your brain does stuff. A label doesn't change that or help that, I don't think.
No, it just makes people put you in a box.
Yeah, and
then that they don't even understand.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't really see the value of it, and it's not my job to do that.
But I mean, do you look at Frank like, outside of the emotional impact of being a compulsive, philandering person as having this, like, almost an addiction?
Definitely. Definitely, definitely. That's, yeah. I've definitely viewed it as those are the three things he likes: smoking, getting blowjobs, and having people clap for him. He really loves those
and
things.
And caffeine, yeah.
Yeah, but in writing music, obviously.
Yeah.
But, so four things. But to the detriment of
everything, all
else,
yeah.
and no acknowledgement of the sacrifices made by all the rest of us so that he could do those four things as much as he wanted. In other words, if somebody had said, now it's your turn, or what are you working on, or what are you thinking about, or hey, let me make sure you know about how money works, or anything.
Yeah, I didn't know any of that either.
Yeah,
how to rent an apartment, but that's so interesting too that you live like it's a sheltered life in a very weird way
because
what sheltered usually means is protective.
Completely.
But it was only protective out of Gail's paranoia and anger, but everything else, moral compasses, learning things properly, all the stuff that you would associate with somebody who's been ridden by sheltering parents to be disciplined, you had almost complete freedom, and then you end up hobbled.
Feral.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But feral, but frightened, right?
So feral and hobbled,
so like
yeah.
You don't, like you're around, naked, people all the time, your dad's out fucking everybody, and, there's this weird kind of thing in the culture at that time, but you end up kind of paralyzed around sexuality and
definitely,
stuff.
Definitely, definitely. I mean, I definitely got some not great messages about women and my own explorations and,
yeah.
And I know that it's everybody's journey. Everyone is going to have to explore all those things for themselves.
Yeah.
But I think that when the world is holding your parent and the parent's choices up as gospel because the label genius. Then,
but also just because they're parents.
Right. Yeah. But when there's also the outer world.
Oh, the outer world. Right. Okay.
Confirming.
Yeah.
That pedestal role, then it's doubly difficult to explore.
I felt the book was like an exercise in my own empathy. I felt bad for you.
Thank you. I mean, I
the whole arc of the Valley Girl phenomenon is just brutal.
Yeah,
it's fucking brutal.
It is.
because I don't know that the way it transpired, and then that. That event where you're thrown on stage in Sweden or wherever.
Germany. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then your mom just says it was because now we can write off the trip. It's fucking horrendous.
As a business trip, yeah.
But, and also just the sort of all the trying, because I share that with you in that, you just keep trying and it worked out for me, but late. But also there's all this embarrassment involved in trying and also putting yourself in situations that you're not ready for because you want the opportunity.
Right.
And it's really devastating.
Mm-hmm.
And, I related to that in a way that my biggest fear in life was, being embarrassed because my mom was embarrassing.
Mm-hmm.
She would embarrass. But, and then I choose this thing, I choose the most embarrassing profession that you can choose. And someone just pointed out to me recently, the reason you know, you do comedy is to re-engage with the family dynamic.
That, you know, but also to heal it, because if you can live through the exposure.
But that is a guaranteed traumatic path.
Yeah.
The idea is like, I'm going to put myself in a position and if I get through
exposure it. Exposure therapy.
Right. But it's crazy because it's just sort of like, you know, put. And I guess it sort of works, but I don't think it helps in processing. I think it gets you, you know, tough.
Yeah.
But I don't really know that it helps to process whatever it is.
Right. It doesn't allow you to feel soft and safe.
I don't feel. That's my biggest fear is now I'm just sort of like, yeah, love is overrated. Happiness is fleeting. You know, I'm okay. I can kind of, I've got money saved. I can eat wherever I want.
Right. Well, that's good that you have a backup plan.
To sit and eat.
That sounds like a good backup plan. But I would say you're allowed to also have joy. I just saw this little talk Brené Brown gave about how
I love her.
I love her so much. About how our biggest fear is feeling joy, because if you've had trauma, then you think you're staving off the other shoe dropping by not letting yourself fully feel the joy. But in fact, it turns out when you feel the joy, that's a reserve in your gas tank that says this is possible. But if you don't really allow it, then you're not building that.
But the mechanism to allow.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you have to identify where that is.
Correct. Yeah.
So like it sounds like a great idea, but like, all right, so is there an instruction book?
Well, you could probably get her on the phone, and then can she give us a two-person
I guess
talk?
So.
Come on.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know if I could get her on the phone. I did interview her years ago.
Yeah.
But the joy thing is too, it's the vulnerability. If you're a vigilant person around, you know, the fear of emotional rejection or pain, the vulnerability of joy, it's like, I don't want to share it. Like if I feel it, even for a moment, I'm like, I'm glad there's no one around. So that's a problem. That joy is embarrassing, that vulnerability. Because I think about this all the time. Mm-hmm. Why am I not taking more chances creatively in exposing my vulnerability in a way? Because, you know, bullies broke me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or emotional detachment broke me somehow.
But you can, it broke you, and that could be a past tense sentence. I mean, this is what I'm fighting too.
Yeah.
You know, I could stay down, you know, fall down 7 times, stand up 8.
Yeah.
And I always think about that Monty Python bit. It's just a flesh wound.
Yeah.
I mean, that's me every day.
Yeah.
when I went to
Because you're so sensitive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the least little thing when I make an effort towards, you know, leaving my house, for example, and something bad happens, I try so hard to have that not reinforce it's unsafe to leave my house.
Or destroy your whole day.
Exactly.
Yeah,
so I went to see Sebastian Bach with Ahmet. I didn't want to go in the first place. But
of all people, Sebastian Bach. Interesting.
It was a great show. He's an amazing showman. It was fun to see, to sing along with the songs I know. We drove 2.5 hours back to where all of our cars were parked, and I lost my car keys and my house keys somewhere along the line. And I wanted to just like, I guess, go after myself, go after that. Like, I had all this energy in my body and I just wanted to lash out. And I just thought, what are the actions I can take? And I was like, I can't call these places until tomorrow when the restaurant opens and when the venue opens. And I was just like, nope, it's just, there's actually just boring steps that.
Well, that's incredible growth.
It is incredible growth.
I mean, like, because I'm the same way. Like, you know, you have a sort of order of things.
That could have derailed me. And I guess other people just have this basic like, oh, what comes up? But I will, if I wanted to, I could set a timer and just be like, okay, have a tantrum, pity party, table for one. And now it's time to do the things we can do.
Yeah. My brother is a guy that, you know, is always like his wallet, everything is, you know, he's always losing everything. So his, like he was in Spain, you know, with his partner, and they'd just gotten there for vacation, and on day like one, someone stole his phone, and just him telling me that, I'm like, oh my god,
yeah.
Was it on the cloud? What is happening? How do you even fucking deal with?
Did you contact the consulate?
Yeah, right. Like I couldn't even handle hearing it.
Yeah.
And he was like, yeah, it was okay. And I'm like, what?
Mm-hmm.
Well, good for you having lost everything in your life all the time that you could just have that acceptance.
Yeah.
Because I don't like admitting to myself that I'm any kind of control freak, but I keep my life pretty small. And it's because, like, and I'm constantly thinking, I'm always thinking, like, literally thinking about, and this is another way I self-soothe, I guess, like, I know how many pens are in my travel bag. And if there's not three and all the little things.
Oh, don't think I don't do a spoon, fork, and knife check and just be like, they all there? They we good? They're still there? They're there? Good.
But it's not.
I don't know why my anxiety rests on my flatware, but it does. And I'm like, okay, Moon, let's count the spoons again.
Sure. But you don't see, it's not OCD.
Oh, and by the way, many are missing.
Really?
And
no, who knows where they went?
That's right. Yep. And I just
flatware. That's interesting.
Yeah, it could be that flatware today and something else. Yeah, I'm sure I have some OCD, and I'm sure it's from wanting to control what I can control for sure.
Well, that's all that vigilance stuff.
Yeah, hypervigilance is it's exhausting.
But like, I don't like. Do you see? Like, because I know, like, I don't rage anymore.
Yeah, I don't.
Because I understand it, where it's coming from emotionally.
Yeah.
And that was self-learning and growth. There are things I don't do anymore because of their impact on other people or on myself.
Yeah.
And do you do the gratitude list business?
I try.
Do you ever ask that question? Like Jerry Stahl always asks me. He's like, when I'm spinning or something. He says, because he got it from Selby. Recovery stuff, he's like, what are you getting out of that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I never understood that question for years.
Yeah.
But, what am I getting? This is my
right
operating system.
Totally. First of all, I think I didn't choose my eye color, my height, my gorgeous little A cups. I didn't choose my physiological responses to things. But once you kind of identify what's in your goodie bag, and maybe it's shittier than someone else's, but you still have to own that bag and do as much as you can with it. And that's
that, and also the brain, you including that?
Of course. Exactly.
The through line of acne in this book is just horrendous.
I can't even tell you how damaging it is to have something that is just something nobody wants.
Yeah.
Out of the gate.
Oh, there's so many moments in the book where it's just like, oh, poor Moon. Just even that thing.
If there's someone who could just deal with my back acne, I can't reach on my back, I'd be most grateful.
But even that thing in the record store.
Oh, yeah.
Like those, because those, I do remember those things.
They're scarring.
Because they're embarrassing and they provoke shame.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, and they provoke comparison. Which is so poisonous.
Mm. Oh, and then the whole cats business, the show. It's like it's all very beautifully written. I enjoyed the book.
Thank you.
I'm just like there's like three chapters I haven't read because I started where I started and I went back to the beginning.
Yeah, and again, I really saw that. We all suffered in our home. And so I was so looking forward to all of us being like, we made it. We did it. Now we can live the life that's meant for us together. Do you know the sibling thing? And so that was, it really is like a loss pile up. And I'm just trying to, as you said, recalibrate what. So, okay. So those are just people I knew growing up. That's so sad to me, but okay.
Yeah, I mean, my brother and I understand him, but I do like look at other families and stuff, and they're not as close as you think. A lot of them, you know what I mean. people get older, they get lives, and you know, who the hell knows what they're going through. And
I literally cannot watch award shows when people thank their spouses or their family or God or anything that they feel supported by. I'm just like,
I just appreciate when they thank their publicists. And then I'm like, finally, an honest broker. You know, I don't know.
No, but I do think some people either know how to self-soothe or they really do have support. And I find it really fascinating. And I think a lot of them come from at least one person really was on their side, like the whole time.
Yeah. I used to say
the gift of childhood boredom so that you could daydream.
Yeah. If you had one good parent, you're probably okay.
Yeah.
Ish.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And how does it feel now that there's an arc to, and maybe I don't want this to sound rude, there's an arc to the relevance of Zappa, you know, in terms of the world. Like now it's a fairly insulated group of people that, you know, are Zappa nerds. Is that a relief?
Oh, I mean, Universal is tasked with generating new material for the current fans and the fans to come. I mean, they've invested a lot of money in making sure that there is content, and there is and there was a vault of a million things that never saw the light of day. Yeah, but I mean, there are many ways that Frank can still be enjoyed and received in new ways.
Yeah.
I mean, I've always wanted to do like a family memoir or to do some kind of a family documentary or some kind of a biopic. Or
yeah.
I mean, I've got 1,000 ideas of ways to keep him seen. And I mean, my book, I hope it brings some interest. And I mean, I really tried to show a side they've never seen.
So there's part of you that still sort of operates from that place where we've got to keep Zappa alive.
Well, less so now, because what I really want to do is keep my own art alive.
Yeah.
But I think that there is, I mean, Dweezil's out there playing the music.
I know.
And
yeah,
when I see little kids shredding
Zappa?
Yeah, on a guitar. It's amazing. Or
yeah.
The drums or whatever. They just, it's.
And does Dweezil, does he have some, is the legal thing working in his favor now? Can he?
Yeah, I think he's.
He can play and make the money off of his.
I think so. I don't really know what the circumstances are. But it was really fun to see Sebastian Bach's two kids.
Yeah.
One playing the drums.
Oh, yeah.
And one playing
searing
guitar solos.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was unbelievable.
And outside of the writing, what's your primary forms of self-expression these days?
Well, I have a tea company.
What's that called?
It's called Moon Unit Tea.
Yeah.
And I just finally, after a million years, launched a website. I know no one goes to them anymore, but that's where you can purchase my tea.
Yeah.
I love making art that makes me laugh. I love taking photos of the valley.
Yeah.
Because it's just such an atrocious, like, it's so awful that it turns beautiful again.
Do you still take pictures of couches that have been thrown out?
I love doing that. Yes. I just took a photo and my kid just painted that photo didn't make, I'm going to send you a picture of the couch.
Okay. And how are they doing?
They're doing amazing.
Yeah. What are they up
just
to?
Art.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, that's
totally
great.
First of all, I think, has my dad's birthday.
Right.
And so it's just, I'm like, you're back. Dad, you're back. Making nonstop things. Like, makes me look like a slacker, which I love.
Well, that's definitely one of the benefits of that upbringing, is that there was some sort of, premium put on creativity.
Yeah. Not mine, but yeah. But as an idea. Yeah. The thing about being around people that are really just self-serving is, if you are a doormat, then you are exposed to the skills you should try to develop in yourself and then come into balance. Because I don't think somebody who's so self-serving can come into balance. They're not going to make their work harder and get the same thing they always get working harder.
Yeah.
That I can see how illogical that would be to somebody who's like, I just grab what I want. I don't. Yeah, why would I have to think about you also?
I never know how people do that. I don't have kids, and I, because of many reasons, all of them choices. But the idea that, you know, people have kids they don't have relationships with is just baffling to me. But it's not unusual.
Right. Well, it depends on what you value.
Yeah, I guess so.
And it depends on if you value that the people that you, you know, supposedly care about, that you want them to succeed and surpass you.
Yeah, well, your mother was threatened by you, so there was no way she was going to be able to give you that.
Yeah, I think parents who really care about their kids want their kids to go farther.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. But that's, it's not a minority, but there's plenty that don't for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. They may say they do, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess I would just say to people that feel marginalized or hopeless or beaten down, like the other guy or the other thing won, that can just be a story that you give a different ending to, and it requires a lot of effort.
Yeah,
but it's. I don't see another path because I refuse to be beaten down by things that are unacceptable. Yeah.
Outside of just life.
Yeah, that's right. Just let life do that.
Yeah.
You know, and the thing is, I also like the idea that we are not our age. We are the energy we have.
Yeah.
And that's important to me, too, because for whatever reason, I might have gotten a temper, but it's also fuel. And that's something Frank would always say. Anger is fuel.
Yeah.
He would say happiness is not a goal, but
I'm on board.
But I would say happiness is a byproduct. Maybe he didn't
finish
the sentence. Yeah, if you do the things you love, it will turn into happiness.
But there's also that thing. It's like, you know, I will be reckoned with. I will be seen. No one's gonna fuck with my output. Look what I did.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and just really do it for yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, at one point, he hired an orchestra just so he could hear his music played by an orchestra.
Yeah.
It was just for him.
Yeah.
Somebody else liked it, too? Great. I mean, that's amazing to me.
Yeah. Well, thank you for writing the book.
Thank you.
It was great. I really enjoyed it. And I'm happy to see you. Nice to spend time with
you. Yeah, it's really fun to see you, too, Mark.
Okay. There you go, Moon Zappa. Oh, heavy, heavy, but great. She's great. You can pre-order Earth to Moon right now wherever you get books. It comes out next Tuesday, August 20th. Hang out for a second, will you?
Manchmal willst du einfach nur ans Meer oder durch die Straßen einer lebendigen Stadt schlendern oder endlich den Moment genießen. Einfach die Welt mit TUI neu erleben. Mit TUI reist du so, wie du willst. Als Familie, zu zweit oder einfach allein. Flexibel, sicher und immer mit dem guten Gefühl, dass jemand da ist, wenn es drauf ankommt. Gestalte mit TUI Urlaub ganz nach deinen Wünschen. Überall im Reisebüro, auf tui.com und in der App.
Hi, this is Sherelle Dorsey from TED Tech, and this episode is brought to you by Solidigm. The world runs on data, and data relies on storage. But most businesses rarely think about how crucial that storage really is. The truth is, it's no longer just a commodity. With new demands and constraints, especially from AI, the old ways of managing data are holding innovation back. Solid-state storage from Solidigm is changing that. It helps reduce energy use, shrink physical footprints, and accelerate data at the edge, unlocking more from your AI infrastructure. Learn more at whatsthestateofyourstorage.com.
People, we've got a bonus episode tomorrow for Full Marin listeners that many people have requested for years. In 2011, we did a live show in New York City that we called The Blue Show, featuring some of my favorite filthy comics, Bobby Kelly, Kurt Metzger, Anthony Jeselnik, Joe DeRosa, Amy Schumer, and Dave Attell.
You have like all these cool fans, you gotta like answer all their emails and like they have questions and shit. That's really fucking, that's a lot of work for you. I know. That really cuts into your self-hate time. It really must like, you must have to set a timer, like, you know, two more emails, one more tweet, and then back to hating myself. I mean, honestly, you know, the office is closed. The buffet of sadness begins.
That episode hasn't been available for years, but we're putting it up on the Full Marin feed tomorrow. To subscribe, go to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. And a reminder, before we go, this podcast is hosted by Acast. And here's some guitar from back in the day. Fonda. Cat angels everywhere.